Buckle up, Junkions. It's time for a fast-paced episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Bruce Dern is forever an asshole. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and colleague. He's a novelist, a screenwriter, a lieutenant of Megaforce, and one hell of a wheelman, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going, sir?
Dude, we're talking about my second favorite Dern today.
Oh, Dern, is that right?
They're Dern it.
Oh.
I'm stoked, man.
You're this Dern is, right.
We're talking about a really interesting film.
See, I thought you meant your second favorite Bruce Dern movie. You're talking about your second favorite member of the Dern family.
That is correct.
Got it. All right. On the
because
same page.
Because clearly, pound for pound, Laura Dern is in significantly more amazing movies and gives slightly better performances than her own father, who is a legend in his own right. She's just a fucking living legend that, you know, 20 years from now, people will look back and go, holy shit, you guys did not totally respect how much you guys didn't deserve Laura Dern. It's like, no, we didn't.
But speaking of looking back, if you would like to look back at our old episodes, you can always do so on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes. And if you're on iTunes anyway, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? Those are very much appreciated. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/YouGuessedIt Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show,
I mean, really like the show.
If you like the show the way Ryan O'Neill apparently does not like the English language, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as $1 an episode, you will get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. At the $5 level and above, you get access to The Deep Dish.
The Deep Dish.
Our monthly foray into the weird
Lost
River of cinema.
The bi-monthly.
But we're trying to keep it monthly,
We're trying to be monthly, but we're busy motherfuckers.
Busy all the time.
And so, but you know what? This month, holy shit, last week's episode is a doozy.
I think you will enjoy. And something that I definitely enjoy is the work of Mr. Walter Hill. And so...
Oh, yes.
It is so... It's such kismet that we get to talk about one of my absolute favorite Walter Hill movies, one of my absolute favorite crime movies that also happens to be a release of the summer of 78. We're, of course, talking about The Driver.
20th Century Fox presents Ryan O'Neill, Bruce Dern, and between them, Isabella Gianni. Three loners playing a ruthless game none of them could afford to lose. In The Driver. Ryan O'Neill is the driver.
My line of work is kind of hard to come by.
His reputation, the best wheelman in the city.
Did you ever get caught on one of your jobs?
Hasn't happened yet.
Bruce Dern is the detective.
I'm very good at what I do.
His reputation, the toughest cop in the city.
You saw the man who was driving the car, yet you didn't identify him. You got a reason?
I just don't like you.
You get out of my town, because you go out on one more job, and I'm gonna nail you.
Two men driven by their need to prove they were the best.
Sounds like you got a problem.
Much better at this game than you are.
You win, you make some money. I win. You're gonna do 15 years.
To them, the money, the law, even their lives no longer counted. Who was best was all that mattered.
Boy, thought!
The Driver. A ruthless game between two legends.
The Driver.
Which is, of course, the end of the trilogy that I've come up with that starts with Baby Driver, and then you watch Drive, and then you watch The Driver, and just imagine it's the same character at different points in his criminal career, because...
Oh, okay, I guess I would watch them in chronological order, in terms of the way, but yeah, it could be the same character.
Yeah.
Like that's, you know...
It's headcanon. If you watch it in the headcanon order, it's that. If you watch it chronologically, guess what? Still three great movies.
I mean, first of all, like this is, in my head, this is part of a trilogy that you introduced me to.
Oh, yeah.
in that your greatest day of programming, the piece de resistance, was one day when you showed The Driver, you showed Thief, and you showed Running Scared. And the reason you showed Driver and Thief was you wanted to point out, hey, this is where Wendy Griffin ripped off stuff for Drive, and here's what he ripped off. And of course, The Driver is a big part of it. And of course, Wendy Griffin, at least at the time, was like, no, this was, we came up with this in a completely different way. And it's like, motherfucker, you remade The Driver. And it's cool that you remade The Driver and called it Drive. But come on, man.
Yeah, for crying out loud.
Now, what I find interesting about this film from the get-go is it's called The Driver, but The Driver doesn't entirely appear to be the protagonist in this film, structurally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of about the detective.
Should be called The Chaser, because it's about the cop who's chasing down the driver.
Yeah, and it's great in that the basic premise of this movie is you've got a bad guy who's really good at being a bad guy, and he's not a good dude. There's nothing good about this guy. There's no reason you should like him aside from the fact that it's Ryan O'Neal and he's fucking cool in this. Because he has no other real redeeming qualities. And as it turns out, Bruce Dern, the detective, by the way, nobody has a name in this movie. Everybody is the this, the that. This is essentially Walter Hill's take on, it's his noir film, and he's playing with the cliches, and he's doing some very interesting fucking shit that we'll get into in this episode. But so this movie is all about this great driver who's probably the best driver being pitted against a cop who's got him dead to fucking rights.
Yeah.
He knows he's guilty. Every time he shows up and pulls a job, he knows it's this guy. He fucking knows who he is. He knows where to fucking find him. He just can't prove it.
Well, see, and I think that's why it works so well as the follow-up to Drive, is because in Drive, Ryan Gosling, by the way, both actors named Ryan, it's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Ryan Gosling is still pretty underground in terms. In fact, he's humping a day job. He's a stuntman for a television show as a day job. And then at night, he, you know, is the wheelman for these robberies. But he's not known to the authorities yet. He's just getting to be known in the criminal circles, because that's the focus of that movie. Where Drive is about the infighting of the criminal underworld, which does play a part in The Driver. The Driver is far more about the cat and mouse of the detective trying to catch the driver. And that to me is way more of the old school noir. It's a lot more about the cops and robbers aspect of the story, and the anonymity kind of playing with the, like, movies like The Killing and Kansas City Confidential, and some really, really great noirs where characters were archetypes. They served as symbols for different things more than they were individuals, which is why none of the characters in this movie have names.
Yeah.
And I really dig that. And this is, like we said, Walter Hill, only his second movie. And that, to me, is...
After Hard Times.
And, of course...
And it's weird, because you go from a movie like Hard Times, which is nothing but wall-to-wall great dialogue punctuated by a few fights, and then you go into a movie with almost no fucking dialogue, that is just pretty much just car chases.
Yeah, but there is a similarity a little bit to Hard Times, because Hard Times, while it does have some great dialogue, does have several swaths of runtime where it's more about presence. It's more about Charles Bronson being in that room and being in that world and just kind of simmering in it. And I feel like that might be the reason why, you know, this role was at one point offered to Charles Bronson, who actually didn't love the way Walter Hill had directed Hard Times, so he passed. And, you know, this ended up in Ryan O'Neal's lap after it went through several other people who said no. And Walter Hill displays it. Walter Hill's career, if you look at his filmography as a whole and you're looking for thematic ties, a lot of his movies are about violence and the psychology of people who commit violence, and the psychology of people who would put sort of manliness above all else and what that really means and who these people really are. So he is a man's man director, but different from somebody like Peckinpah, he wasn't writing characters who were just tough guys because he liked tough guys. He was interested in what made tough guys tick and what made violent people be violent. And I feel like that's one of the cool things about The Driver is there is so much of a split between who we know The Driver to be and his kind of code. And then when push comes to shove, how he breaks his own code is really interesting as well. So there's a lot of what would become Walter Hill already like in the nascent stages in just his sophomore movie.
Well, I think it's what's really interesting that you brought up is the fact that Walter Hill is obsessed with violence and violent people.
Yeah.
And in this particular era where he really excels he started off as a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we know Walter Hill, the director. Walter Hill was a screenwriter that he started out as a screenwriter and then wrote his own shit for quite some time. But the thing that he did is he wrote criminal movies where you like the criminals, but the criminals aren't redeemed. They're not redemptive criminals. They're not, oh, he's really, you know, it's not a hooker with a heart of gold story. No, these people are criminals. These people are bad. Like in The Warriors, as follow-up to this, The Warriors fuck with people.
Well, The Warriors is set in a universe where pretty much all of New York is criminals.
Yeah, it's just run by gangs and a city with 8 million people at the time had 100,000 gang members. Like, do that math. The math in the universe of The Warriors is there's essentially one gang member for every 16 New Yorkers.
You never see a character in The Warriors who's not either a gang member or a cop.
No, there are a couple of people who are getting hassled.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
And
oh, no. The person you're thinking of right now in that scene is an undercover cop. Are you thinking of the woman in the park that James Remar messes with who ends up being an undercover cop?
Yeah. But then there's several other people that they run afoul of over the course that they see that.
Okay. Yeah.
And they're just, the thing is you realize, oh yeah, these guys are still fucking thugs.
Yeah.
These guys, even though they're the protagonists that we're following and we want to watch them get back to Coney Island, they're still fucking scumbags.
Yeah.
And Ryan O'Neal in this is still a fucking scumbag. He's still an untrustworthy guy who, by the way, won't spring for the extra dollar for a TV in his room.
So automatically we know there's something wrong with him mentally.
We automatically don't trust him. What do you do in a hotel room alone for that long without a TV? Sorry, pal. But
are you familiar with Jackson Pollock? Because I think I have an answer for you, sir.
Yeah. a little bit. Junk Food Cinema, the only podcast that mentions both Jackson Pollock and Ryan O'Neal at the same time. By the way, can we take a trip to the sidebar?
Oh, yep.
Sidebar! All right, so we are talking about Ryan O'Neal, and we're going to talk about how cool Ryan O'Neal is. And at this point in history, Ryan O'Neal is pretty fucking badass. Yes, he became a very problematic train wreck over the course of his life. And,
oh, I actually don't know about this.
Oh, he's full Brando.
Oh, no.
Like one of the famous stories was he went to his ex-wife's funeral, Farrah Fawcett's funeral, and he met this blonde there and at the bar and immediately started hitting on her at the funeral. And she just looked at him and said, "Dad, it's me." He was hitting on his estranged daughter, at his ex-wife's funeral. Like, this is what Ryan O'Neal has become. So he is not
Baby Driver, am I right? Guys. get me out of here. I'm terrified.
So there may be some people out there going, are we really going to talk? Yes, we're going to talk about Ryan O'Neal because at this point in history, he was actually pretty fucking awesome and a fucking movie star. But yes, we do also acknowledge that he became a problematic mess and we are very sad about that. But yeah, he went full on Johnny Depp. He went full Brando, full retreating into the world with his money and alcohol and not doing so hot. So those are the there are lots of Ryan O'Neal stories that I have heard over the years, and all of them make me sad because this Ryan O'Neal is fucking great.
So now we're down, so we can only go up from here. Wow, that is horrible.
Yeah, I can't believe you hadn't heard that story.
No, I would.
Dad, it's me, Tatum.
So anyway, The Driver. Yes, you're right. He's a character who does not have a lot of redeeming qualities. In fact, the relationship he has with the female lead of this movie, played by Isabel Adjani,
Isabel Adjani. If you watch the trailers for it, she completely drops that first syllable altogether.
Fair
enough. Adjani. By the way, the trailer for this, I believe we played a trailer at the head of this episode.
Yes, we did.
I hope to God Meryl played the great fucking 35mm trailer from way back in the day of this. That just...
If he didn't, he's now heard this part and he's gone back and put it in.
Because, dear Christ, that voice. And that trailer's just...
Is it Don LaFontaine or is it the earlier guy who is like who did a lot of the horror movies back then?
I think it's the horror movie.
Okay,
guy.
Yeah.
On opposite sides of the law.
That trailer, that 35 trailer, is pretty remarkable. Just in the way it's structured and like the graphics they use and that guy with that voice. And I think you pointed out all of the dialogue.
Pretty much every bit of dialogue in this movie. This is the other thing about The Driver that I'm so fascinated by and was the clear inspiration. While there is one scene in particular that was directly lifted for Drive, the big inspiration here is the lack of dialogue in this movie, the quiet space. It's just about the act. It's all about the crime and it's all about, you know, these brooding characters. And that's essentially what Wendig Refn did. When they made Drive, the screenplay was not written that way. There is actually whole swaths of dialogue they threw out for Drive because Refn was just like, here's the only line that matters. This is the only line that matters. And so they would have those spaces where they just kind of stare at each other. And in those spaces is all that dialogue that they're just communicating non-verbally. And it was such a weird choice that was clearly inspired by the crazy stuff that Walter Hill did here.
Ryan O'Neal speaks a total of 350 words in this entire movie.
Yeah.
He speaks...
we can't even get through the business of this fucking podcast in under 350 words.
I could tweet more words currently than he says in this movie. It's kind of fucking ridiculous. But what's interesting is there's a... Just looking at The Driver versus Drive in terms of, you know, on this level, you can see the differences in style of filmmaking from era to era, because what is one of the biggest takeaways most people have from the movie Drive? Apart from Ryan Gosling and the stunt work and Oscar Isaac and anybody involved, it's the soundtrack.
Oh, God, yes.
That soundtrack was epic.
Blistering synthwave that created an entire subculture that you guys have heard me talk about quite a bit, especially in the old days. I'm a big OutRun fan, and I'm a big fan of this reemergence of synthwave, but synthwave that is inspired by a version of the 80s that didn't really exist. It's music that's kind of inspired by the film and video games and comic books of the 80s that create this kind of landscape where my head was in the 80s, but that didn't actually exist. So this wasn't the type of music anyone really listened to, but it was movie soundtracks, and then it's been blown up. You know, people like Carpenter Brut have become, you know, huge on the scene and inspired a number of others. And now we're starting to see movies be scored with that kind of a soundtrack. You see Like our good friend of the show, Joe Lynch, did a wonderful film that you can see on Shudder called Mayhem out of that kind of soundtrack. But yeah, all of this came out of what Wendig Refn figured out for Drive, which what he essentially did was he was driving around listening to music with Ryan Gosling, and they were talking about the movie, and he was apparently said, no, wait, this is the movie. The movie is you driving around listening to music. And I think that that's how he tells the story, but it's like, it's that plus the driver. Like, it's just limited talking. It's just driving around.
Which is why, to me, Baby Driver has to be the first movie of that series, because Edgar Wright lives and breathes soundtracks. Soundtracks are how he writes movies in the first place. Like, his movies start as soundtracks that he weaves a narrative around to create bookends in a really interesting way.
And oddly enough, Edgar, how he made that movie was he had made it was an idea he's carried around for almost 20 years. It was one of the things he wanted to write when he was a young filmmaker after he made his first indie film that none of us talk about, his parody film.
Fistful of Fingers?
Yeah, Fistful of Fingers. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to make it after that and didn't know how to do it and made a music video, I think in 2002, about it, which where he made a music video for a band, and that music video was about a driver, a wheelman, who was listening to music while he was waiting for the other criminals to come out, and all him playing around with the windshield wipers and things like that, and then of course finally went and made that movie. And of course now the difference between Refn and Edgar is that Edgar wears his influences on a sleeve and is unafraid to talk about all of his influences. And this was definitely an influence on Baby Driver.
Now let's think about Baby Driver and Drive in terms of how those scenes work, how those chase sequences work. You know, you think of Baby Driver and you think of the Bell Bottoms song that's playing in that opening. You think about Drive and the ticking clock song that's playing all through the...
Oh, are you talking about Kaminsky?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now tell me what song is playing in the car chase of any point during The Driver.
Nothing.
Not a goddamn thing.
That's the thing, is it's such a quiet fucking movie. It's so goddamn quiet. And that's what's so amazing and interesting about it, is it really is just a quiet meditation on this crime and of these two guys. Like, it's interesting because... there's a certain meta-ness to it that I'm in love with. Here's the brilliance of The Driver. The Driver is about a wheelman getting into car chases who is being chased by a cop. And that chase is going on the entire movie. The entire movie is about the chase. It is a chase movie filled with chases.
Yeah.
It's
Chaseception.
Yes, it is Chaseception. Like, it is a cat and mouse game filled with cat and mouse car chases that are really very interesting and really amazing. And also, one of the interesting things about that movie is it's the type of movie that it's very hard to make in this day and age, because there's so much technology surrounding us that you could not do you could not remake The Driver today. Not in the way that it is, because it's, oh, hey, we know who he is. We have enough surveillance on him that, yeah, we're going to nail him at some point. Like, yeah. There's just no, like, here, this is from a time where, oh, shit, he turned a corner and we don't see him anymore. Oh, he got away this time. Maybe we'll get him next time.
That's what I kept, like, okay, so the basic plot of this movie is that Ryan O'Neill is the best wheelman in town. He is pulling, you know, these jobs, and there's a cop on his tail. And then he gets roped into a job he really doesn't want to be a part of. We mentioned the fact that he's not a good person. He's kind of a scumbag. And I think that actually is illustrated in the fact that when in the beginning of this movie, when he pulls off this heist, which is the scene that is 1000% lifted for Drive, there's a witness. There are actually multiple witnesses, but there's one witness in particular who could identify him and doesn't. And the result...
Isabella Gianni.
Yeah. The result is Bruce Dern and Ryan O'Neal take the exact same tactic with her. Both of them show up at her apartment to intimidate her. Both of them. And it is the weirdest thing because you realize that antagonist, protagonist, it really doesn't matter. This is a story about two men who have a job to do, who are relentless in the way that they do it, and not especially likable. And it, to me, it culminates in the fact that they both go to her apartment to lean on her, even though from Ryan O'Neal's perspective, she's already said she doesn't, he's off the hook with her, and he still goes to her apartment to lean on her. It's so strange. And then Bruce Dern shows up immediately thereafter also to lean on her. It's like every guy in this, every, like the protagonist, the antagonist, they both have a job to do, and they don't give a shit who gets hurt in the process. They're going to get that job done.
Well, and that's what's so fascinating about this movie is thematically, it is Walter Hill talking about the fine line between these two characters. Like, they're just on opposite sides of the law. Other than that, they're the same fucking dude.
Yeah, and that's why that 35 trailer is so great. Is because it gets that.
Two men on opposite sides of the law.
And they literally, like, flip. They have, like, almost mug shots of both of them, which I think is very telling. Because, in many ways, Bruce Dern is kind of a criminal himself. Like, he's ready to shoot any fucking buddy.
Well, not only that, he's a cop who's running his business, you know, out of a fucking bar like he's a mob boss.
Yeah.
He comes across...
He's the fucking Ron Perlman character from Drive as a cop.
Yeah.
It's fucking crazy.
Yeah. And that's what's so nuts about it. Like, he's running it out of a bar, and he's unafraid to fucking throw the book at people.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what happens is he wants to nail the driver, so he sets the driver up on a bad job with a couple of knuckleheads.
Yeah.
And he knows better than to do it, but ends up going with them anyway.
It's basically... The main focus of the second and third act of this movie is basically one giant act of entrapment where Bruce Dern busts another bank robber and says, you can either do 10 years in prison or you can help me set up the driver and walk away scot-free. And the thing is, Ryan O'Neal knows pretty much from the start that something is up. He sniffed these guys out. He knows. He initially turns them down. And then the more violent, and this is kind of the cool thing about the way the script is structured that Walter Hill writes, is you think the guy with the glasses is going to be kind of the, apart from Bruce Dern, Ryan Neal's chief antagonist of that crew, but it's not. It's sort of the second in command who gets told that he has to sit the fucking job out, who turns out to be the bigger threat to Ryan O'Neal. And I found that interesting how they set up the dude with the glasses to be, you know, the rat and the guy who's going to cause a lot of problems for Ryan O'Neal. And then it turns out it's the second in command who Ryan O'Neal's like, I don't want that guy on the job at all, who turns out to be the bigger problem.
Also, there's a great moment in here that is your favorite scene in this movie.
Yeah.
That also gets borrowed for a movie we've been talking about for years covering. So take another drink, Junkies. Eventually we will cover Quigley Down Under. you know what the connection is with those, because that moment's quite, you know, borrowed. But yeah, he doesn't like guns.
Yeah.
They, like, of the 350 words he says, one of them is he doesn't like guns. So when the guy goes to draw a gun, in fact, my wife said, uh-oh, he doesn't like guns. And then, of course, he draws a gun. It's like, of course he has a gun.
By the way, what's a weapon you never see Ryan Gosling hold in Drive? It's a gun. Just saying. There's a lot of fucking... I'm just going to point it out one more time. No, I love that scene because that fucking wormy dude with glasses thinks he has got the driver dead to rights. Think he's really got the drop on him. And then Ryan O'Neal, who has been called... This needs to be pointed out. Who's been called the cowboy by Bruce Dern throughout this whole movie... pulls a fucking Smith & Wesson revolver circa 1863 and shoots this dude through the window of his own car. It's such a great framed shot. Like, I love it every single time I watch it because this guy's like, oh, you should really have a gun for a guy who talks as much shit as you do. And then you still don't see Ryan O'Neal's hands because the driver's door is open and he's standing behind it. And all of a sudden he draws this gun like fucking Wyatt Earp and shoots through the window and kills this guy. It's so perfect. It is like, it's everything I love about filmmaking kind of in one sequence. Like I think Walter Hill does an amazing job of not only writing that scene, but also framing and shooting that scene. It's incredible.
Gentlemen, I'd like to pause the movie for just a second to talk to you about something very important. Underwear. Now I know what you're thinking. When we were kids on Christmas morning, we were quite upset when we got just underwear. That's exactly what I want to talk about, because for me, for the longest time, underwear has been just underwear. And then Mack Weldon came into my life. Mack Weldon is not a villain in a Highlander sequel. No. Mack Weldon is better than whatever you're wearing right now. Mack Weldon is a premium men's essentials brand that believes in smart design and premium fabrics. Now, just underwear is exactly what I knew about Mack Weldon. From hearing about it on other podcasts, I ascertained that they were a shop that sold only underwear. Turns out that's not true. I know this because I recently got a shipment of underwear, the most comfortable underwear I've ever worn in my life. Oh, by the way, great pairs of socks, a great polo shirt, and even a wallet. We're talking about polo shirts. We're talking about pullover jackets. We're talking about, yes, underwear and socks, but also accessories like hats and wallets and overnight bags. Guys, you need to go to Mack Weldon. It is so easy to use. I went on there and within a few clicks, this package arrived to my door. Like the angels that usually deliver my curly fries and my queso, delivered unto me a box full of, again, the most comfortable clothes I have ever worn, and it's time for you to get aboard the Mack Weldon train. I still think he's a villain I have to decapitate. Get out of here, Christopher Lambert! Anyway, this is the part with the call to action. So for 20% off your first order, visit MackWeldon.com, that's MackWeldon.com, and enter promo code STARGROVE at checkout. Mack Weldon, it's time we all grew up. I mean, not me, but you know what I mean.
This movie is a masterclass in how to tell a story without words. Like, that's what's great, is it is so sparse, and it doesn't feel sparse. Like, it feels Spartan. In fact, that's the word I should use. It is Spartan. Mm-hmm. It is clean in its lack of dialogue. And you're always fascinated and you're always in it. And the movie, for a movie with very little dialogue, fucking blows by. Like, it is a breezy fucking movie. It's like, hey, look, the movie started. Oh, it's over. Holy shit. And also what fascinates me is the genius of this film is the structure of it, to where you get to the end and you realize you've just watched a heist movie.
Yeah.
Even though it's been set as a chase movie, there's actually a big heist going on.
Oh, it goes full Ocean's 11 by the time this is over, where you're like, oh, I thought we were, oh, that was, oh, interesting. That's how they did that the whole time, right under our noses.
I don't care about the money. Maybe I'll send it to him.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll give it to my cohort so that I could totally screw this guy over in the end.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And it's great because you don't really know who you should be rooting for throughout this whole movie, and then you still feel victorious at the end. Well, how does he do that?
Because it's got that great edit. First of all these ninja cops who just,
yeah,
a smoke bomb. We appear
coming from the Sci-Fi Channel. Ninja cops.
It's really a great moment where just he goes to the locker, and then we just all of a sudden there are cops there. In any other movie, you'd hear the rustling of all those feet, and instead, no, he just turns around and they're all there.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, haha, we got you. What's in the bag? Nothing. And he realizes, and that's the moment where Bruce Dern's like, fuck, I just got played. Like, I literally put everything on the line for this thing. I set this whole thing up, and he fucked me. Like, and there's no witnesses. There's no nothing putting him anywhere. He got away with it again. And it's great.
Yeah.
It's just great. It's such a weird movie for the summer of 78. Like, when this series, we're going to talk about a bunch of very interesting stuff. Nothing like this. Like, this is so on its own in a summer with Grease and Jaws 2 and Piranha and disco movies and just all the nuttiness here's this dark little fucking noir film without much dialogue. It's just fucking cool. Like, one of the other movies we wanted to cover isn't streaming anywhere, and it's hard to find. It is probably easily in my top three of favorite films of 1978. It's called Hooper. Seek it out. It's a stuntman movie. It's, of course, by another patron saint of junk food cinema, Hal Needham. It is a wonderful film, and I wanted to do it back-to-back with The Driver because they're such very, very different movies. But that's a movie that is a drama about stuntmen and the stuntman life, and it is Hal Needham's love letter to stuntmen. And then in that same summer, you get a pure stuntman movie where it's about a driver and it's fully loaded with stunts. And it's just this quiet, sparse noir film that there would be nothing like for another 30 years.
Yeah. And I think that's important to note is that, you know, as much as we talk about the characters and the filmmaking and the cinematography, because this movie is, it's shot by the guy who shot Breakfast at Tiffany's and The Pink Panther and, you know, like really like super highly regarded films. The chases in this movie are incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Music or not, like they are phenomenally well constructed.
I feel like this movie kind of gets short shifted in terms of talking about great car chase movies.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's flanked by so many great car chase movies.
Oh, yeah. People are going to tell you about French Connection. They're going to tell you about Bullet, which, by the way, Steve McQueen was one of the first people offered this role. And he decided he didn't want to do anything that was related to cars anymore because he's like, I've done Bullet. I've done The Getaway. Like, what else can I do? Like, it felt like he had said all he needed to say in that department.
The Getaway, by the way, written by Walter Hill.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, no, Walter Hill wrote a bunch of really great crime screenplays before he went on to direct great crime screenplays. So he wrote two great fucking car chase movies, but the one he wrote gets more play as a car chase movie than the genius one, which honestly, my money, pound for pound, I think The Driver's a better film than Bullet or French Connection or The Getaway. I think in terms of what the movie is and how the movie plays out, I think it's a significantly better piece of cinema.
I agree.
Like, those movies are great. And their car chases are, oh my God, phenomenal. But in terms of raw cinema, like this is a film. Walter Hill never made another film like this. Like, he made a lot of great films. And we will at some point probably cover all of them. Because, dear God, they're amazing. But this was such its own thing, which is so interesting. Because Wendy Griffin, you know, made two films that were pretty much the same. The second one wasn't as didn't come out as good as the first one, and went off to do even more weirder shit. But this is a singular film in Hill's career where it's like, this is just it doesn't feel like anything else of its time or in Hill's career.
And we need to we've touched upon it a couple times. But maybe I need to pay this off. The scene in particular that you watch in this movie, and you cannot deny that Refn ripped it off, is during the opening car chase when Ryan O'Neal is driving around two bank robbers, and they're being like the cops are everywhere. They know where they are. They're chasing them. They're very close behind. He gives the cops the slip and then pulls into an alley and shuts off the lights and just waits. And then as he's rolling out of that alley, there's a cop coming the other way and the lights go on. Like, it's shot for shot, frame for frame, the way that Ryan Gosling gets away from the cops in the opening chase of Drive. Like, for
which,
him,
by the way, and pound for pound, I think the opening 5 minutes of Drive are not only one of the best opening 5 minutes of any film in the last 10 years, but pound for pound is better than the opening of The Driver.
I would
rips off The Driver, but Refn did it better.
Well, and here's another thing too, and I don't mean to sound like I'm kicking Drive in the balls. I love Drive. I love movie so much. I think where Refn actually improves a little bit upon the structure of this movie, and improve might be a too harsh a word. He was going for something different. He gives Ryan Gosling a heart. There's save the cat moments all over that fucking movie that Walter Hill does not feel the need to give to Ryan O'Neill at any point, because that's not what Walter Hill's interested in. Walter Hill is not interested in humanity. Walter Hill is interested in the darkest parts of the human brain that can make people do things that they do. And so Drive and the Driver, you know, Drive borrows a lot from the Driver, but it's aiming for something completely different. And I think that's why it's so interesting to watch those movies back to back, because you see a different type of storytelling, a different objective in Refn than you do in Hill. But that's one of the things that's always interested me about Walter Hill, is that Walter Hill doesn't feel the need to give characters a conscience, but it's not in, I don't know, it's not in a douchey way. He is more interested in the people that don't have a moral compass. And we see that so much in his movies. In the movies we've talked about,
oh yeah,
we see that so much.
Yeah, well, even in his cop movies, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Even as in 48 Hours, the cops are not totally on the level.
Look at the way Nick Nolte treats Annette O'Toole in that movie, and yeah, tell me all of his characters have to have a moral compass.
Dude, and especially the movie he made before this, Hard Times.
Yeah.
Dear God, James Coburn fucks over anybody he can. He's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Then you get to the Warriors. The Warriors are not upstanding fucking guys.
Don't tell me Tom Cody's actually in love with Diane Lane.
Bam.
Come on. Like, that is a pride thing. That is Tom Cody saying, you're not going to get one over on me, Willem Dafoe. Fuck you. That's so much more about what that movie's about. Or fucking, again, not to play an old song, but look at the way Nick Nolte treats Maria Cachito Alonso in Extreme Prejudice. Like, this is a common thing with Hill. He doesn't give a shit if you like these people, because it's about what makes those people tick.
Yeah.
It is a fucking psychological evaluation. He is breaking open the cinematic DSM-4 and just going to town on these characters.
Because that's what fascinates him.
Yes.
And that's why he was such a fucking powerhouse for so long.
Yeah.
And made, you know, mostly great movies.
Yeah. Not all great movies, for sure.
Yeah, no, there's a few parts of his you know, as with most filmmakers. But again, more good ones than bad.
Agreed, 1,000%.
And this is one of his best. I mean, it is just, it's not his, and the thing is it's not his most enjoyable. There are other films I enjoy more than The Driver. But The Driver is cinema. Where so many of the movies he makes are flicks, this is a film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a movie with something to say. This is a thing where he plays around stylistically different than anything else. And it is a wonderful little fucking movie.
And I love what the producer Larry Gordon said about this movie, is that they treated it as an art film. They treated the movie as an art film, not as an action film. And that might be why, critically and commercially, the movie was not a success. But they were all very proud of what they put together. And I think he's dead on. I think the fact that this movie was treated as a piece of art and not just an action flick hurt the movie, but also in the long run is why we're talking about it and why it's one of my favorite movies ever, is because they have a... And it's why... You didn't see a movie like this for 30 years after it was made.
Yeah, this is the type of film that junk food cinema was made for. Like, it is a movie that most everyone else wrote off at the time and throughout history, but it's one of those that when you watch it, you're like, you can't ignore it. It is a film that is great on its own. And by the way, if you want to have a great badass fucking double feature, guys, this and Thief pair so well together, like a cheese and a fine wine. Oh my God, does it pair well. You really introduced me to that. You want to talk about two good, quiet heist movies by masters at the peak of their fucking powers. Those movies are it, man.
I also find it interesting that... when Steve McQueen and Bronson both said no, they went to a very young but very popular actor named Sylvester Stallone, and he turned it down because he was fist deep in his current project, Fist. So he ended up turning it down, but I always thought there was...
For Fist, not Rocky, for Fist.
Fist, the movie Fist, yeah. So he said no because he was still working on Fist. Have you seen Fist? I've never even seen Fist. I feel like most people haven't seen Fist.
I feel like that was one of those movies I watched at 2 in the morning during a bender of Stallone films and was like, wait, what? I owe it a revisit. Yeah. Now that I'm thinking, I'm like, shit. But I'm sure there's some junkies out there who will be like, yes, you need to revisit it. Or, dude, no. Yeah. Your first impression was correct. And it's Vietnam. Don't send any more troops.
Junk food cinema. It's Vietnam. Don't send any more troops. I want to talk again about this scene that I've mentioned that was borrowed liberally for Drive, where Ryan O'Neal is waiting in the alley for his lights off. And then when the cops do show up as he's driving out, he plays a game of chicken with these cop cars that ends in a pretty spectacular crash. I feel like if Edgar Wright borrowed anything from Walter Hill, it's that Walter Hill in this movie showed he has a particular talent for bookending and for foreshadowing. Because that exact scenario plays out in the climax of this film, which we haven't really talked about, but the ending chase of this movie is every bit as good, if not better, than the opening chase of this movie, which is a feat in and of itself.
And the thing is it's not... What's amazing about the chases in this film, and the reason why this film gets neglected on this, is the chases themselves aren't spectacular in the way that so many other car chases are. When people talk about, you know, we talk about Bad Boys 2, or we talk about Ronin, or we talk about Bullet, or we talk about, you know, just the frenetic nature of French Connection. This is not that. Instead, this is a very well-orchestrated cat-and-mouse chase that really puts you into the car and that feeling of being pursued.
Well, it's because so much of current action filmmaking, the currency is destruction. The currency is mayhem and destruction. I mean, yes, that's how you judge action movies anymore. And for better or for worse, I mean, we both love the Fast and the Furious movies, and they traffic
most of them
fucking disaster. Like, that's Fast Five.
In fact, I would argue at this point, half of them.
Yeah. You know what? Fast Five, it's a whole stock and trade is destroying half a city block.
The safe is on the move.
The safe is on the move. That's not what this is about. There is destruction in these chases, but it's about this sort of dance between the cars that is captured perfectly. It's like it's like kind of the same way that Kubrick approached like space. That's how Walter Hill approaches car chases. It's about the movement and about the beauty of the movement between the cars in the chase more than it's about anybody crashing the car or, you know, I mean, it's about the art form of the chase. And I think that's why I love it so much. But in that final chase sequence where, you know, the violent member of this other gang that was kind of sidelined and turns out to be the bigger bad is being pursued by Ryan O'Neal in a red pickup truck that looks like he hijacked something from ZZ Top. And what's great is that he's keeping pace with a fucking Trans Am. I mean, he's that good of a driver that there's nothing he can't drive and keep up with in a chase. Like, it's such a perfect communication of that idea. And this chase ends with the two of them playing like Marco Polo with each other in this factory. It's really fascinating. They're like weaving between all of these crates, and Ryan O'Neal just shuts his car off and listens and waits to hear the squealing of the tires to know where they are. And when they find each other, we get a callback to that chicken sequence, Chekhov's chicken, where they're coming at each other again, and the young driver that the big bad is using flinches first, and that car flips in a way that is so dangerous. And it's, again, one car, not an entire city block. There's no explosion. But that car flips in such a way that you're like, oh, thank God there was no driver in there when they did that. And then you watch the shot again. Somebody moves in that driver's seat after the car lands. There was a fucking stunt driver in that car.
Yeah, there was.
That should not be alive today. That is such, because it doesn't just flip. It flips and bounces off and falls into like a crevice. Like,
this is why I wanted to watch this back to back with Hooper, because Hooper is all about those guys and their drive to outdo each other and to do that one last stunt and do that memorable stunt and not say no and do that crazy fucking shit like that stunt.
Yeah. And it's incredible to watch. I was blown away by that. And the fact that you can see someone moving in that driver's seat, and it's just, how in the world did nobody die making that stunt? And that, to me, is everything that this movie is. It's more about the minutiae. It's more about the mechanics of situations like that and the quiet spectacle of a car chase more than it is the destruction. And it's amazing. And you're right, we didn't get another film like this for 30 fucking years. And it's the reason why I don't just count this as one of my favorite Walter Hill movies. It's just one of my favorite movies, period. I love this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great fucking film.
And it's crazy to think that it was almost Charles Bronson. It's crazy to think it was almost Steve McQueen. It's crazier to think that it at one point was going to be Sylvester Stallone. But to kind of wrap up this discussion with where we started with the triple feature, the film's release date, the driver's release date, is actually at one point featured in Baby Driver. It's Baby's inmate number.
Mm-hmm.
The inmate number is 28071978. That's fucking awesome.
Because, like I said, Edgar wears his fucking influences on his sleeve and has no predilection to pretend that, oh, no, I'm not ripping off or borrowing from something else. It's like, no, these masters fucking walk before me, and I'm following in their footsteps. And there is no shame in that.
Yeah, and that's why I'm so glad we got to talk about this. It's one of the best films, purely best films of the summer of 78.
Might be Ryan O'Neill's best film.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Maybe Paper Moon.
So it's the best movie featuring a woman he didn't later hit on. So there's at least
I mean, he probably, I don't know.
We don't know for sure.
I mean, I know there's a lot of Barry Lyndon fans out there, but this is definitely my favorite Ryan O'Neill.
It's the movie that taught me who Ryan O'Neill was. Like, yeah. I haven't actually seen a lot of Ryan O'Neill's
stuff. Well, Ryan O'Neill was best known for the movie Love Story.
Fuck that movie.
Yeah, I hate that movie. Well, yeah, but that movie was a huge hit.
That's part of the reason why I hate it, is because it profligated this horrible, fucking toxic view of love. The tagline of that movie, the most famous line, love means never having to say you're sorry. Go fuck yourself. Love means learning when to say you're sorry and saying it a lot, because that's... What do you mean never having to say you're sorry? You're never culpable for anything you do because you're in a relationship? Fuck off.
Jesus, Brian, tell me how you really feel.
I will, damn it.
Christ.
I fucking hate that movie. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I was not going to defend Love Story. Because I'm not. Like, it's one of the classic, it became the model. Like, everybody ripped that off. And so, up through the 90s, we still had those fucking movies where we put two beautiful A-list stars together and they fall in love. And, you know, things go rough. And then they get back together, and then one of them is diagnosed with cancer, and they die.
And apart from being completely emotionally manipulative, it perpetrates the idea that pride is more important than putting the other person in your relationship first. It's fucking dog shit. Yeah.
It's why I actually love, and we will cover this one day, I promise you. I will convince you into letting me do a romantic a love story month. Not a romantic comedy month, a love story month.
As long as we don't have to watch Love Story.
No. But there is this great movie called A Walk to Remember.
With Mandy Moore?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Which is a gargantuan middle finger to Love Story. The movie, it's an inversion of the entire formula. It's, oh, wait, no. The first act twist is she's sick, she's dying, she's not going to live very long. And so this guy who's kind of smitten with her decides to go ahead and help her fill out her bucket list and accomplish all these things before she dies. And then, just as you would in any of these movies, they fall in love, she dies. And instead of the maudlin, instead the ending is this very light, loving, bright and happy talk about her funeral and how everybody spoke at her funeral and the joy of her life. And it is, the movie ends not with sending you out crying, but sending you out happy that this girl in her short life achieved everything that she ever set out to. And in terms of thematics, it is a huge middle fucking finger to Love Story. And also because of the because it's a Nicholas Sparks story, it's also the anti-Nicholas Sparks story, because Nicholas Sparks would then rip off Love Story like 18 more times. I'm so mixed on Nicholas Sparks. There's a handful of good Nicholas Sparks movies out there, and then the rest of them are just some of the most cloying, obnoxious pieces of shit.
At least read the plot synopsis for the movie The Promise.
Oh, me and Will Goss went and saw The Promise with Britt Hayes and my wife all together on a Thursday night at 10 o'clock when we had the theater to ourselves. The Promise is amazing in that it's not at all good, and yet it's amazing.
You know those model Washington monuments you can buy in D.C.? I want Nicholas Sparks to sit on one of those because...
Did you watch it?
Fuck that guy.
Did you watch the movie? Yes. Oh, my God. Oh, it's not even the worst Nicholas Sparks movie.
What's the one? Okay, the one with Colby Smulders and I want to say Timothy Olyphant, but it might be Josh Duhamel. Now I don't even know if it's a fucking... It's the one where his dead wife is like a character in the movie, but it's like a Shyamalan twist where you don't know it's the dead wife until the end. That might not be... Maybe that one's not a Sparks movie, but it feels like a fucking Nicholas Sparks movie.
I'm not sure which one that is.
I don't know exactly how we got on this topic.
Ryan O'Neill and Love Story led us to Nicholas Sparks.
It sparked this conversation about how much I don't like Nicholas Sparks.
There's a couple of really good ones, but Walk to Remember is kind of like, you were talking about your loathing of Love Story. A Walk to Remember is the antithesis of that. It's a complete inversion in the best way. And it is, oddly enough, the most charming either of those leads have been.
It's called Safe Haven, and it is totally based on Nicholas Sparks.
Oh, God, Safe Haven. Oh,
Safe Haven is a garbage fire.
Yeah, no, there's one that really made me angry a few years ago. It had like 7% on Rotten Tomatoes, and me and my wife were watching it, and it was really good, and we were really enjoying it, and we're like, why does everybody hate this? And then it gets to the end, and the twist at the end of that movie is so like, wait, did I just fucking watch a movie in which our leads reconnect after 20 years and fall in love, and it's these two charming actors doing this great job, and they fall in love, and then he gets shot and killed, and the heart gets put into her sick, dying child? Oh my God. Oh my, fuck you.
I just imagine...
Fuck you.
I imagine that famous reverse pan from Jaws as you're watching the ending of that movie. Like, you dolly out and zoom in at the same time.
It's like... What? Well, and the thing is, like, in that movie in particular, like, Gerald McCreary's in it, and Gerald McCreary is so charming and wonderful in that movie, and you're like, I love this movie. Why does everybody else hate this? Oh, fuck this
Incidentally,
movie.
Has the same ending as Terminator Salvation, so there you go. Congratulations.
Oh, wait, you were talking, hold on. You talked about The Promise.
Yeah.
I was thinking about The Choice. Which one is The Promise?
I don't know. Maybe it is called The Choice. I don't know. I can't keep these fucking
The one
titles.
About the... You talking about the one about the woman who's in a coma?
Yes.
Oh, that's The Choice. Okay yeah. We are talking about the same movie.
I am not, in that case, pro-choice. In only that case, I am not pro-choice.
Yeah, no. The Choice. It's a movie where they... I love how this is how we end up the Driver episode. It's a
movie. We just took a big left turn from the Driver.
It's a movie in which a guy falls in love and... they have a love story, and then she goes into a coma, and she's so unlikable. You want him to pull the plug and find love again. Like, you just can't. Like, can we please get to the part where he pulls the plug, pull the plug, pull the plug, please, for the love of God, pull the plug. Like, you want him to pull the plug. And then that's the big twist is, oh no, she got better magically. And it's not a Nicholas Sparks movie after all. They both live happily ever after. And you're like, I was a Nicholas Sparks movie. I was promised someone would die. That's how these things happen. Someone always dies.
Yeah.
Even if it's like one of the better ones, like the Lucky One, where the whole big twist is, oh, hey, it's not either of the leads that die. It's the problem. The problem dies and everything's great. It's like, oh, that's the twist. Yeah, it's, dude, I have a love affair with Nicholas Sparks because the dude knows how to come up with a concept that just like hooks you. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, I see how that's a romance.
Welcome back to Sparking Your Interest, the podcast where we talk all about the filmic adaptations of writer Nicholas Sparks.
Oh, dude, we need to have that episode.
No, we don't.
I think we need to have that episode.
You know what? We're just fine. Sparkle! And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And this one is going to be a little bit of a cheat because we just talked about this one a couple weeks ago. But I feel like we have to mention the fact that the bar where Bruce Dern has set up shop, because all detectives need to do their business out of a bar like a fucking mob boss. Did you happen to catch the name of the bar?
No.
Torchy's.
That's right, it was. That was the name of the bar. I did see that. I didn't realize that was the bar he was in, was Torchy's.
The bar is called Torchy's.
Well, then, yeah, let's do some Torchy's fucking tacos.
If there is one place in Austin I wish had a drive-through window, it is fucking Torchy's. Because they... What?
The Torchy's up here by my house has a drive-through window.
Shut the fuck up.
No, like, I have a drive-through Torchy's.
But you know how rare that is, right?
Because I do know that I live in a magical part of Austin that has a Torchy's with a drive-through, yes.
Because literally, I have been to six other locations.
It also has an amazing porch. It's an amazing porch and a drive-through.
Well, there we go. We are going to stop this podcast and drive through the drive-through of a Torchy's taco. And
For their Tokyo Drift?
They have a taco called the Tokyo Drift?
They had it in June. That was their special.
Awesome.
They had the Tokyo Drift.
That's perfect. The Tokyo Drift from Torchy's that you get through the drive-thru at this one magical location.
What I would recommend, like for those of you Austinites listening, if you would like to do a driver pairing, I highly recommend getting the Republican and the Democrat.
Ooh.
And ordering them, you know, have them both. Because that is your driver pick. It is these two great tastes pitted against each other. By the way, Torchy's, Obama ate at Torchy's and was asked what to order. And of course, he's a party man. So he went with the Democrat, even though the Republican is the better taco.
Actually, if I remember that video correctly, he said, I'll take a Democrat. And I guess better get a Republican too. He was like,
oh, that's right.
Cause he is
that's right.
An actual deferential, like decent human being.
He probably also looked at the menu and said, holy shit, the Republican looks amazing, because it does.
Yeah.
It's a fucking sausage, wrapped in a tortilla with tons of good stuff.
Yeah.
The only thing I like better than that is essentially the Super Republican, which isn't called the Super Republican. It's called the Ace of Spades. It's a double size.
It's called the Super Pack.
It's a double-sized taco with eggs and the Republican sausage and a bunch of other great stuff. It's fucking amazing,
This podcast somehow not brought to you by Torchy's Tacos. I think it's like the fifth time we've talked about them on the show.
Because they're fucking Torchy's Tacos.
Yeah,
man.
They're amazing. I get the trailer park trashy with no pico.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, you get a trashy.
Yeah.
Tell people what trashy is.
So at Torchy's, you can get tacos trashy, which means they take off all the vegetables, and instead of that, they put queso on it. It's basically a Salisbury special, where it's like, we're going to take off all the green stuff, and we're going to put cheese on. We're going to put queso on it instead. I actually really do like the green chilies, though, that come on the trailer park, which the trailer park is just a piece of fried chicken. And if you get it trashy, it's a piece of fried chicken with queso cheese and green chilies, and it's... I want three of them right now. And you get the special Chipotle ranch to put on that bad boy.
Mm.
Oh, man. That is my day made. And you know what? And I'm going to eat those tacos while watching The Driver again. And maybe watching my triple feature of Baby Driver, Drive, and The Driver. Or my other triple feature of The Driver, Thief, and Running Scared. Because you can't go wrong either way, I feel. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
On Twitter, at Massaworm, MASSAWIRM. And Instagram, at Massaworm.
Fantastic. You can find me on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury, and of course you can find the show at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean, you kind of like the show.
If you like the show as much as I hate the movie Love Story, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to content that nobody else gets to hear, and there's a lot of fun stuff there, guys. I think you'll really enjoy it. So we're going to go ahead and put the pedal to the metal and peel on out of here and see if that Torchy's drive-thru is still open.